I hold, like, for historical reference, like, there's certain dates everyone's supposed to know. That's what I hold. And one of them is the First Crusade.
Oh.
1096. 1096. Very good. Here, there's so many people here, maybe I'll take attendance. What happened to my
name?
Hopefully you'll remember that. Hopefully we'll all remember that. Come on, cover. Come on, if you can't keep quiet, this class of people keep quiet. Thank you. It's just a very important reference to keep everything in mind. That's what I hold on. It's like 1492, you know? Something also important. 1453, fall of Constantinople. These are like important dates which everyone's supposed to know. 1789, French Revolution.
Okay, this is European history. We're Americans.
2008
in the World Series. As we're going to see, the First Crusade is a very important definitive event for Ashkenazi Jewry. For Ashkenazi, I think we meant basically overall Ashkenazi Jewry right now.
Nusaf Svard,
Ashkenazi.
Just Chassidim,
that's right. Okay. Now, it's like this. This is an important thing to understand, which I only got down recently, but it's important to understand. There are two, at this point, there were two key places where Jews were living in Ashkenaz. One was northern France, and the other one was the Rhine Valley. Northern France and the Rhine Valley.
Germany.
Okay. Well, Germany at that point in time was a geographical expression. It was not really a unified country, as I hope we're aware of. The general rule is, and this I saw by Chazan.
Was the Holy Roman Empire still around then?
The Holy Roman Empire was alive and kicking. The Holy Roman Empire is from, the year 800 into the year 1806.
It's a thousand years.
Well, we all know what Voltaire said about the Holy Roman Empire, don't we?
It's not an empire.
Okay, a little more complicated than that.
I know Voltaire said that.
Yeah, that's Voltaire's famous line. He has a couple of famous ones. This is the most famous.
That's not true.
No, his most famous is, I don't believe what you say, but I'd fight to the death for your right to say. That's the most famous.
Now, there are two things which are both true, One thing is that even though France was feudal at the time, the monarchy and the high aristocracy maintained a lot more law and order than the Germans. That is true. In other words, France stood the unification of France really started about, you know, towards the end of this period, and we're not going to quite get there. That maybe next week. I don't know if we're even talking about it. It will come in next week. But over here, France was feudal, and in other words, there was not, even though the monarchy claimed officially ruled the entire country, that didn't mean that much. But what was important was that they did really maintain one order throughout the country, which is definitely important. Now, in Germany that wasn't true. There's another issue, which is like this. And we're going to get back to that later on. And that is banking. Banking. As it's well known, Jews were heavily involved in banking. Usury. That means banking.
Just
merchant of Venice. Mischievous. Merchant of Venice, right, that's right. So now, what's the point? The point is, this is Sazam Chumash, that a person shouldn't take ribbis, shouldn't take interest from their fellow, from their comrade, you know, like in very modern terms. In Jewish law, in the Halacha, as we know, that you were really not allowed to take ribbis. However, because, as we also know, economies don't work well without banking, and no one's going to lend significant sums of money to people without making money off of it. There are halachic ways to get around it. Now, of course, the way it's done, it's not, this is a classic example of, if you oversimplify things, you say the rabbis simply loophole and circumvent, you know, got rid of ki'ilu ribas, but it's not really true. It's a lot more complicated than that. It's a very complicated part of the halacha. Now, at that point in history, the Catholic Church paskened that Christians should not take ribas from each other. That's what the Catholic Church's psak at that point in time. Later on, they initially, don't ask me why, initially they said Italians are allowed to do it. That's like in the mid-1300s. Most people shouldn't do it. Don't ask. But Italians can do it. Okay, I'm not sure why. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to find someone who clearly explains it, but there's no question that that is historically what happened. But in the 1100s, in the 11 and 1200s, the only people from let's say around 1100 until 1230, 1250, depending on where you are in France, the only people allowed to offer loans at interest were Jews. But it's true in Germany also. But there's a key difference between France and Germany. In France, it was not as sprawling of a country with more secure borders. And that's probably why, but I'm not sure. Maybe it's just, you know, a couple of smart people in the right place. They were trying to build the country. And because they were trying to build the country, and the people who were running the country understood it's a good idea to have banking, so the king and the ducal courts gave Jews government backing to collect their loans. You understand? You know, there's a big problem. Especially, you know, the right to bear arms is a very fundamental part of American society. And the reason why, you know, why is that part of the Bill of Rights? And the answer is because if I can control who has weaponry, then the people who have the weapons have a certain physical advantage over people who don't have the weapons. And the right to bear arms in medieval and later Europe is not a legal right. I'm not sure at what point it became actually illegal for non-noblemen, non-members of the army to bear arms or not. But the fact is heavy arm was more or less a government monopoly. And Jews certainly weren't allowed to bear arms. So if you lend someone a lot of money and the guy doesn't want to pay you back, you have a problem. Because, he's not going to, how are you going to force the guy to pay you back? So they had government backing. In France, they had government backing. And in Germany, they didn't have government backing. And I personally, even though it's not pointed out, I personally think that's also one of the reasons why the French maintained the law and order more or less through the Crusades, and the Germans didn't, because you know the maintenance of law and order, you know, a good rampage means hit the Jews, and that's going to ruin your banking system, you're going to make sure it doesn't happen. Okay, you know, kill a Jew here, kill a Jew there. Okay, no, people die. But if your banking system is going to be gone as a result of just allowing chaos to break out, you don't want that to happen. And in France, they basically did not allow that to happen. And even though I didn't see that, you know, I saw this in in Chazan's book. It can be quite clearly substantiated that the key yeshivas pre First Crusade were in, you know, Vermeise, Mainz. That's where Worms and Mainz. And afterwards, they can move over to France. And there's absolutely no question, as when we heat things up, I'm going to show you it's explicit in one of the kinas on Tisha B'Av. I'm always aghast that they don't have a kinas here at the office tomorrow. It's a straight, affront to Rabbi Soloveitchik's memory. We'll get there. I'll explain that a little more.
I remember that. It's not in those terms.
Another way we could also substantiate this is that the kinas, which we're going to hit in a little while, the kinas are only about what happened in the Rhineland in Germany and not what happened in France. So I'm not saying nothing happened in France, but France was much calmer during this period of time as compared to Germany. Now, it's not. I can't resist this. I'm going to just throw it out at you. Professor Chazan states, he's just dead wrong. I mean, it shows you everyone knows their piece of history. It doesn't really bother always re-researching not someone else's piece of history. He says it was mainly mob violence in Germany, and the France didn't allow mob violence to get out of hand. Now, according to my books on the Crusades, it's not true. According to my books on the Crusades, it was properly led, by middle-level aristocracy violence in Germany. there's a slight difference. Though later on, there are things which were definitely mob violence. the letter arms, and whatever other things. Those are much lower level. But it isn't really true. There's definitely at least one major significant case of. I mean, according to the book I have in the Crusades, this was like the main band which ran from one community to another, killing them, was led by one of the nobles in the area. What are the German nobles?
Why is it?
But so that's why I say the reason why in Germany, because there's no governmental backing for Jewish loans, and in fact, Jews only engage in small-level loans, not high-level loans. In other words, when you don't have backing, so you let somebody. It's like my great uncle owned a clothing store in a very small hick town in Alabama, Bessemer, Alabama.
Bessemer.
Okay. Yeah, now I never understood. I was in that store a number of times when I was young, and when I was older, I could never understand how they made a living off of the store. So once I was shooting with my father, and I asked him, "Dad, tell me, how did your father make a living out of that store? I never saw a client ever come in and buy anything." So the answer is, he was a loan shark. he used to loan all the Schwarzes money.
Really?
Yeah, 24% interest. So I said, how did they collect? He said they had no problems collecting. These were people who needed that loan every single month. People who need to go back to the bank for more loans, make sure. In other words, if someone who's a guy who's, I don't know, a schlepper or doing a low-level job and spending a little more money, or he's like perpetually in debt. And if he doesn't go back and pay, who's going to lend him? Who's going to give him money on his paycheck? Okay. So because he needs that every month, then he has to make sure he pays back. So small level loans you can always give, but when you're giving big money, you need government backing. If you're lending someone $500, maybe even $1,000, do that on a small. That's small time today. You know what I mean? But if you're lending out big money, $10,000, $20,000, much bigger stuff than that, you can't go do that without some real power behind you. So and again, in Germany there was no power behind the Jews, and in France there was. Thank you. Okay. Going on. As mentioned. Yeah, let's see the Shoga text says. As mentioned, the Crusades have a very black name in Jewish history. And some of the most moving kinnis are about the Crusades. Years and years ago, let's see, should I figure this out again? I won't figure it out exactly. About 25 years ago, I had this list to hear Reb Chaim Nielsen Darshan kinnis. He prefaced that, whatever. He was saying, for Rabbi Soloveitchik, blah, blah, blah. And unfortunately, I didn't record that or take notes. It was a real mistake. That's one of the things. Sometimes you don't do something and you like regret it for years afterwards, and that's one of them. But it was definitely, it definitely opened up kinnis for me, and I can definitely clearly tell you that without that, I would have never, I always say, I've said Shirim many times Erev Tisha B'Av on Kinnis. I've said on Tisha B'Av a couple times also, not during the day. I don't like doing it during davening, because I hope Kinnis is something you say yourself. And if someone speaks, if you speak before each one, maybe that breaks the momentum. I like to get into it as much as I can. So, anyway, so the kinnis to really, I enjoy the kinnis so much now. I hate to tell you this, but I've found some of the most like earth-shattering chiddushim in kinnis, especially Reb Lezer Kalir. Reb Lezer Kalir was like,
hero.
Reb Lezer Kalir wrote about
40% of the kinnas. About 40% of the kinnas of Reb Elazar Kalir, and Reb Elazar Kalir is like, he's like such an unbelievable Mechadish. He's very difficult to follow, an unbelievable Mechadish. I've had Kiyulu by Tisha B'Av ruined finding such massive conditions. I'm not sure exactly who you're referring to. I'd have to see the kinnah. What kinnah we're talking about?
He's not talking about kinnahs. He's trying to throw out the fact he knows somebody who wrote some Jewish
paper.
Rabbi Elazar Kalir. Yes, correct. Rabbi Elazar Kalir also has stuff for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But that's not what we're going to talk about right now. Right now, I'm going to just show you briefly because I can't resist. This is like an ongoing taiva of mine. That people should relate to kinnahs in some sort of natural, normal fashion. But we're going to start here with kinnah chabad. There are two key kinnahs which speak about what were called Xeris Tatnu, the First Crusade. There are two key kinnahs. One is chabez, kinnah chabez, and the other one is kinnah chabad. So, kinnah chabez, it's actually, I've been through it many times, and I wasn't absolutely sure if this is a reference to the First Crusade, but I noticed that someone printed this past year in the kinnahs with Rabbi Soloveitchik's comments, and I read it that he you know, kind of kilo, I don't know, he holds that his book speaking about the First Crusade, even though it's not absolutely clear if that was what was going on. But this is really this one is one of the most like emotional, moving, you know, it's like graphic, very graphic kinnah. Should I give you a quick example? I'll give you a quick example here. Let's see if I can find it. Okay, here we go. They got together with holiness and purity to be Mekadoshem Shemayim. Ishas Achim Chizka BeEzra. They all encouraged each other. V'hidabek B'yir Tahara, to have proper Yir Shemayim. B'li Krol Amadazar, not to bow down to an idol, because according to most Rishonim, Christianity constitutes Shitus. And mamash vadazara, but it's like it's minus.
Is it like a pretty big machlokas whether it's considered overzara or not?
There is a machlokas, correct. Because Christianity is shitut. No, for us it's definitely wrong. For us it's definitely wrong. The question is for a non-Jew, right? Is Christianity usher? For a non-Jew is Christianity usher, and that's machlokas rishon. But for us it's shitut.
Is it to be over vadazara or?
No, that's totally. In other words, that's dependent. If you hold usher for them, then you can't. Then they're not. You're not allowed to have them be, you know, say shuva, swear in God's name, and whatever. That's here. We grow. V'lochasu gevra gvira. This is very famous. V'lochasu gevra gvira. Apanim tzviras tifara. And the mothers and the fathers do not have any compassion on their children. Avol alzu gvuri yizera ha'al rosh likras shedra. They girded themselves with extra strength to knock off heads and what would you call it?
Necks.
Not necks.
Spinal
cords. There you go. And they said to them, "We have not merited to raise you to Torah. We should offer you like sacrifices. And we will merit with you for the great light. Hatsfuna me'en kol va'aluma." This is like, okay, it goes on with all these type of, it's a very, very moving kinnah. I'm telling you, it's a very moving kinnah. Unfortunately, this guy doesn't bring the shlo. The shlo, I believe the shlo says on this kinnah that I don't remember, it says something like, if you cry in this kinnah, it's not to have difficulties or something like that. Can't quite remember. Other people do bring it. This guy doesn't bring it. Anyway, it's not, even though it's not absolutely clear from the Lashon HaKina that it was written about the First Crusade, even though it's not really clear, there's no question. In other words, there's a very famous document called by historians the Mainz Anonymous,
the Mainz Anonymous. In other words, it's a chronicle written by someone who was in Mainz, which is called Magencia. And it describes, instead of more of a historical, this is written quite poetic. I mean, I tried to translate it in a prose fashion. The Keen is written with poetic meter, etc., etc., etc. But that's written in prose fashion. It describes more or less the same type of things. So that's one Keena. And over here also very, isn't this one? I think it's the next one. In Chafei, and this I just, again, I can't, wait a second, I forget to tell you that. Yeah, this is a major Machlokas Rishonim, by the way. It's a major Machlokas Rishonim if you're allowed to do that. If you are being threatened with forced conversion. So obviously, forced conversion to Christianity, you're obviously not allowed to do it. What are you supposed to do with children under the, you know, who are not able to make a conscious decision? Is one allowed to kill the children or not? So, it's a major machlokes rishonim. I'm not holding it to say it over with any real accuracy, so I refuse to spew it out in an inaccurate way. But if all I can tell you is, it's just applying rule number one, and that's a major machlokes rishonim. The old minhag Ashkenaz was without question to kill the children. Without question, as we see here in the Keen. Now, going on to Chaf Hei, which I can't, again, I can't resist Chaf Hei for more than one reason, and you're about to see why. Going on to Chaf Hei is a relatively clear description, again, in poetic form, of the destruction of Ashpira, Vermeise, and Magencia, which is Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. And before this, again, the main yeshivas were in Worms and Mainz. And because of the First Crusade, the Worms and Mainz yeshivas were abandoned. That's very important. But besides that, there's more going on here. So I just want to... When did these things... When did the First Crusade happen? When did all these massacres of the First Crusade happen? 1096. 1096, right? 1096.
No, I'm
thinking
myself.
Yeah, okay. 1096. But they all happened. It's quite clearly documented here. And it's also, you know, I don't know, confirmed in non-Jewish sources. All these happenings happened March, April, May, June. And 2.5-3 months in 1096. Okay? Now, in the middle of this,
in these three cities.
It's unclear. I don't think we'll get to the Holocaust, but we'll get to Tachmatat. Maybe I'll talk about it a little more.
Kalmanuki
is Tachmatat. In pre-modern times, to talk about numbers is basically impossible.
43.
It's basically impossible. No one knows how many Jews started over there to start with. So no one definitely knows how many survived. They say there's old Jewish folklore, which I didn't track down in any accurate source, that anyone whose last name is Spiro, etc., any one of those, you know, permutations is descended from one of the survivors. There was 8 survivors or 10 survivors or something like that of Speyer, of Ashpira. Ashpira and Shapira, the name in Hebrew is Shapira, which in English could either be Spiro, Shapiro, or Spiro, or Spira. They're all like more or less the same thing. There is Jewish folklore which says that they all were descended from, you know,
everybody is all Ashpiros Ashkenazim?
They're all Ashkenazim. I told you already, I don't know, I didn't see that in what I consider an accurate source. So I called it Jewish folklore. Could be not. I have no idea. Okay. Now, in the middle of this, when he's talking about all these things happened, starting from the middle of Iyar in 1096, and the last one recorded here happened on Shavuos. That's when they all happened. They're all relatively well documented in the Keen. They are relatively well documented in the Keena, and I guess I'll go. I guess I'll do it in the order I wrote it down. Now, in the middle of this, after he's describing all this, the Python says over here, let's see, You should tie to your heart a very bitter eulogy. Because the death of these people is equivalent. And because we don't have the ability to make a new day of Atinus. Therefore, we cannot make it earlier, we must make it later. Therefore, today, Tisha B'Av, is the time that I cry about this. And I cry with a very bitter soul. And I do what Rabbi Salvation gives, is I cry from the morning until the night about it. That's what he says, that's what Python says. So, one of the times, I don't know how many times Rabbi Salvation met Menachem Begin. But I know it was definitely at least once.
Yeah.
What? They were Landsleit, as they would say in Yiddish. Landsleit means they're from the same place. They're both from Brisk. And this was so well known, like, I was reading The Prime Ministers by Yehuda Avner, and he, for some reason or another, was not aware that Begin and Rabbi Salvechik are Landsleit. He wasn't, like, so surprising. He went to a lot of Rabbanim and Menachem Begin, so it's not, you know, he went to the Babaji Rebbe, he went to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, he went to Rabbanim. He valued Rabbanim's opinions as, you know, legitimate, important opinions to hear. Yeah, I don't want to talk about Menachem Begin right now. I'm just telling you, that is definitely factual. So, one of the times that Menachem Begin was by Rabbi Salvechik told him, get rid of Yom HaShoah! You should get rid of Yom HaShoah. The day of national mourning for the Jewish people is Tisha B'Av. And I'll prove it to you. Look in the Kena. Okay, Begin's response is not clearly recorded to me, at least. So I'm not sure exactly what Begin said back. But
Kevin spoke about it and he said he came back. He was going to abolish it, but he was just completely overruled.
He was overruled. That's fascinating to hear. That makes logical sense, but I'd like to see that document.
Yom HaShoah was justified because of the educational purposes. That, like, Yom HaShoah, I mean, Tisha B'Av is like a day for mourning, but like a day for education would be like, why Yom HaShoah?
Whatever, not now. I don't know why people get emotional about things like this, because I don't think. Let's go on. That's just a famous story. Right?
Just get emotional about whether or not you're paying too much or something. You're not
getting
emotional about the
whole. Okay, so, let's go one step. Now, that's the first thing about. One thing clear about the First Crusade, Tatnu. One thing very clear about it, and this is very clear, is we say Kinnus on it every year, Tisha B'Av. We say Kinnus on it every year, Tisha B'Av. The other thing, which is also without a question clear, is every Shabbos morning, we commemorate Tatnu.
We commemorate
Tatnu, the First Crusade. Does anyone have any idea what we do? What?
Avraham.
Feldman gets it. Got it, Feldman. We say Avraham to increase the Torah and Muslim. We have any proper Yankees here? Proper yekas. That means you daven in a real yekas shul, where everyone wears talisim. No one. Okay. Now, there are. I didn't. Years ago, 25 years ago or so. An old yekas friend told me.
But you daven in
shul. No, never daven yekas shul. Told me that what? Very close. Just right there. Feldman. One time everyone Vadai says Avarachim is Rosh Chodesh, is Shabbos Mechorchim Rosh Chodesh of Rosh Chodesh Sivan, and even if Rosh Chodesh Sivan falls on Shabbos, we still say Avarachim, and the reason being, if you look in the Kina, it says
If you look in the Kina, it says, "Uvachodesh Hashlishi, Rosh Chodesh Sivan, the Kriyas Hallel L'Shara, when they were in Shul saying Hallel, Hishlimo Nash and Ba'ava Kshura, they were in the middle saying Hallel, the Crusaders came in and killed them. Chlula Kesel Rosh Ma'afra La'atra, they were all wearing their tefillin, and they came in and they were killed." The Crusaders came in and killed. So that's why as a result of the fact that these massacres happened specifically in this time, that is why Avraham is set at this point. It's definitely set at that point. And the truth is, as we say now, every Shabbos, there are some Yekesh Akilos, I'm almost done, there are some Yekesh Akilos which only say it the Shabbos before Shavuos. There's some which only say it then. But everyone definitely says it then, yeah.
In the article, it says during the Omer, we even say it on Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, whatever.
Okay. So now, there is what I call Irbuve Dvarim about these Inyanim, which people don't quite understand, and I'm going to say my opinion here right now. And I haven't, you know, I unfortunately didn't have time to do, if I had another 15 or 20 minutes, I would do another piece of research to try to prove what I'm saying. But I'm really confident what I'm saying is right. Does anyone have a Siddur Vilna here? Downstairs, someone has one?
Siddur Vilna?
Siddur Vilna.
Oh, not that
one. Yeah, your brother loved the Siddur Vilna. Your brother liked the Siddur Vilna also.
Does he still use it? Does he still use it?
What I think is, and again, I'm like missing what I consider final critical proof to this. There are two customs of Sefiras HaOmer, as we know. There's first Omer and second Omer, right? Now, all non-Ashkenazim, for the records, do the first Omer. All non-Ashkenazim, and whoever was here earlier knows that all non-Ashkenazim should not be called Sfar. Yeah, Persian Jews, only very, very small percentage of them ever were in Sfar. There are some rare ones who can say, but most Persian Jews were there since Churban Bais Rishon, more or less. Mordechai and Esther, you know, that's what they were there since. So they are called Eidut Mizrach. They are not really called Sfar. Yeah, to be accurate.
Yemen also,
and Vilchain Halavis. Most Syrians, I was just speaking to a Syrian yesterday, and I asked him if his family comes from Spain. And he says, I don't know, we know we come from Syria. I said, so you definitely don't come from Spain, because whoever comes from Spain definitely knows about it. Whatever, so I don't know if you know any real Yotzei Sfar. If you do, you know what I'm talking about. I'll tell you a story another time. Okay.
Why do people just assume if you're light, you're Ashkenazi, you're dark, you're Sfar?
Coleman, that was such gross oversimplification. We're not going to talk about it right now. Okay?
Right.
Okay, I can tell you a lot of interesting stories you can ask me over dinner, but not now. Hopefully not during the Seder. Okay. The proper minhag Ashkenazi was called second Seder. I want to theorize, even though I'm not mamish, I'm relatively sure about it, not 100% sure about it, that the reason why they instituted second Sfira as minhag Ashkenaz was to also commemorate this tragedy of the First Crusade, because as we see from the Kina, almost all of them happened, almost all of these massacres happened during the what we call the second Sfira period. That's my personal theory, and I'm pretty sure it's true, but I haven't quite. There's a nice amount of substance to it, but not enough to like say 100% of it. That's what's going on. Now, that's also probably why, you know, they say you say Avarachman during Svira. That's the wrong way to put it. Yeah, that's sort of true. But it's not Svira which is Mechayim Avarachman. It's because of the Tatnu massacres, and the sphere was instituted in Ashkenaz because of Tatnu, because of the First Crusade. That's why, and all those key massacres, as we see from the Kina, happened during what we call Sphira time. That's why the Minig Ashkenaz of Second Sphira was probably instituted. That's what I think. Okay, let's go on now to the Rashba.
Let's go on to the Rashbam. Okay. The Rashbam lived from 1085 to 1174. He was Rashi's great-grandson. His mother's name was Yocheved. His father's name was Reb Shmuel ben Meir. And his father's name was Meir.
Rashbam or
Rashba? Rashbam. Rashbam. He's the guy, and you have a Pesachim here, you see back in the... You see an Arabic
Pesachim?
Yeah, Rashi's not... Rashi. You see, Rashi's not quite Rashi, then we would throw in the Rashbam.
Right.
Okay.
How do you relate to Rashi?
He is Rashi's oldest grandson. Rashi's oldest grandson.
Why don't we know about his dad? Who's his dad?
His father's name was Remer ben Shmuel, and we know something about his father, but his father's not as close and famous as he is.
His father
didn't
run any major wars. No, his father did do something important. His father, he learned by Rashi. He learned, the Rashbam learned by Rashi, but he also learned by his father, Remer, who had a yeshiva at Arap Rupt. Now, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. I'll show you how it's written. I know in modern French, I'm not sure actually how you would pronounce this in modern French.
Arama should do?
Rim. Sahi probably speaks perverted Canadian French.
Ramelu.
No, I don't see, because if there'd only be one letter there, I'm sure you wouldn't say it in modern French. But you could more or less prove, you can prove from the Bali Tosfos, the way the Bali Tosfos wrote the French words. In other words, for example.
Ram erupt. That's similar.
See, this is the city.
It depends where you live. See, the Orleans or Ireland. Like, he does Ireland, right?
No, like it's like this. In modern, in English, you say Orleans. Like, New Orleans.
No, you say New Orleans.
What? Orleans or Orleans?
Orleans.
In French, in modern French, you pronounce it Orleans.
No? Yeah, no way you pronounce it like that.
Orleans. I exaggerated a little. French, like, you know, Polish speak with like straw in their mouth. French speak with their nose all the French, you almost all the vowels they pronounce through their nose.
How do you speak through
your nose? Orléans. I'm not that one, but I took French 1 year in high school, like a long time ago. So almost 30 years ago. But the Tosfos write this or. Or Talamud.
Orleans.
Orleans. That's how the Tosfos is written. Paris. French today.
Paris.
Paris. Paris. Only dumb English would say Paris. But French, as your Tosfos is written, Paris.
Oh, so it's really just dumb Frenchmen who don't know how to speak their own language, you say.
Well, that's a very, very
corrupted
nice...
The language.
They corrupted their own language. It's not our fault they corrupted their language. Yeah, but, okay, whatever. It's a little more complicated than that. I'm not sure. Interesting question. Point is, in modern French, I'm not sure what happens.
It's wrong.
If you know that, Ram-Ru, or Ram-Ru, I'm actually not sure. I hope to ask a French friend of mine how you pronounce this so I can tell
Ram
you.
Ram erupt.
Definitely not. Definitely not. Okay. Anyway, point is Rabbeinu Meir, the Rashbam's father, started a yeshiva in Ram Rupt, or whatever we would call it. He started a yeshiva there, which is very critical because after the Crusades. After the Crusaders wiped out the yeshivas in Mainz and Worms, it was very important to have yeshivas somewhere else, and they already had them in, you know, in Ravru, whatever it's called. As I hope we're sort of aware. The Rashbam is closer to his grandfather, Rashi, and he has an uncle who I'm always going to like blurb out you, whose name is the Rivon.
What?
The Rivon. You've never heard of the Rivon. I can't mention everyone, because if I did, it wouldn't work. We would get nowhere, absolutely nowhere, and I think everyone would be so bored, it would be too much. But anyway, but Kitzer, point is Rashbam is more like Rashi's grandfather and his uncle, Atali's father, in that he was a mafarish, he was a commentator, rather than a rather than one of the Balik Tosfos. The Balik Tosfos are going to be invented, the concept of learning is going to be invented by Rabbeinu Tam, which we're not going to speak about this week, I'm going to speak about next week, because we got distracted enough talking about the Crusaders. But the Rashbam is much more like his grandfather again, and uncles and other people. There were other people misnasing, other people doing that style of parshanus of comment of Torah work at that time. Definitely, you know, in Tanakh, we definitely know that the Mari Kra was also wrote Pirushim, and it's highly likely that others also did, because there's at least two known versions, two slightly different versions of the Mari Kra, both attributed to Mari Kra, who was, again, like in between. He's like the same time as the Rashbam's father, in say, for Shmuel, for example. So we know a lot of that type of parshanas, a lot of that type of, you know, commentating and Torah work is being done in Ashkenaz at that time, and the Rashbam also did that. Now, this is just an interesting point which can't resist saying, so you're going to hear one of my historical chidushim, which I hope to substantiate later. My mom is probably substantiate. I'm going to bring another email Rabbi Goldman. No, I'm going to email Rabbi Goldman, hopefully. Rabbi Goldman, and see if he can substantiate this for me. Okay. The Chidah says that the Rashbam wrote Perushim Tashas. The Chidah says the Rashbam wrote Pirushim to all Shas. The only things we have are Babasra. The only things that I've ever seen are Babasra and Arvim Sava. That's what I have seen. Okay? The Chidah does state that he does write, that he wrote the rest of Shas. Now, if you look what the Chidah says by Rebbeinu Gershom, the Chidah doesn't say he was Mufar Shas. He says, I saw a Ksav Yad of Rebbeinu Gershom on Kachim, and later he says that I compared it to Rashi, and then Amar is not the same thing. You can see Rashi did his own independent work. I am not completely independent, but it's really his own work, and it's not just Ki'ilu, you know, paraphrasing, adapting Rebbeinu Gershom. But again, the Chidah states, I saw the Rebbeinu Gershom's commentary on Kachim, and in fact, we have printed in every Vilna Shas, every standard Shas today, we have printed Rebbeinu Gershom's commentary on almost the entire Kachim. Almost the entire country. Now, from the fact that he doesn't testify that he saw Rashbam on the rest of Shas, rather he just says as a fact that the Rashbam was mafarish the rest of Shas, strongly leads us to believe, leads me to believe, at least in the present moment, I call this strong circumstantial evidence, that he had not actually seen a parish from the Rashbam on the rest of Shas. Rather, there was what we call, you know, second-hand evidence from Rishonim, quotes here and there, which imply that the Rashbam wrote a parish on the rest of the Shas, but he actually did not see it. Yes. Now, wait a second. Now, we have a lot of, no one knows the exact percentage of Kisvayada manuscripts which survive. Experts say they don't think more than 10%.
So wow.
No more than 10. Well, Jews used them. They just write them to have a month or two every, you know, 100 years decide to look at it. Jews wrote them and used them.
Lost
their lot. It wasn't just lost, it was also somewhere burnt, unfortunately. We'll get to that in a couple of weeks. So besides that, they were used. Smart to use, you know? They used smart. So we don't know. Now, what we do have, the Rashbamals wrote a parish on Torah, and in the Art Scrolls, they say, they don't even bother mentioning this, but someone printed about 20 years ago a parish from the Rashbam on Gohelis. Yeah. So again, I have seen Rashbam on Kehelis. I have seen Rivon on Yuma. I have seen Rivon. Rivon's Rashi's son, the Rashbam's uncle. I have seen Rivon, fascinating Mufarish. I have seen on it's fascinating. So two different people printed, you know, different parts of the Rivon on Yavamas.